Good evening and welcome to Sports Takeover. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to RMU Radio. I'm Matt. Alongside me, as always, is Chris, and we are going to dive right in with the segment making its season two debut, First and Short. Chris, start us off.
Well, we're going to start in NASCAR. Last week, we gave the season preview for what the postseason is to look like. First race happened this past weekend. Martin Truex Jr. won at Las Vegas, secured his spot in the round of 12. So these next two races, he can do wherever he wants, but he's already locked in. Pretty much the whole top 10 in the race was people who were in the playoffs, and Eric Jones did the worst of all the playoff people, so he has an uphill battle these next two races, but Martin Truex is a lock for the next round.
Yeah, as it stands right now, Kevin Harvick is at number 2, Joey Logano at 3, and on the outside looking in is Eric Jones, as you mentioned, Clint Bowyer, Kurt Busch, and Ryan Newman, so those guys have an uphill battle in front of them.
This week, Richmond at 7 o'clock on Saturday night, another race winner there, gets their ticket punch in the next round.
Pittsburgh Riverhounds update as their regular season approaches its end. They still are in fifth place. They're at a record of 14-4-9, 3-1-1 in their last five. They are only 5 points out of first place. Two teams above them have actually clinched a playoff spot. The rest is still up for grabs in the East, and they are right in the middle of it.
Yeah, they have two games in hand on a few teams, one game in hand on the team in first place. So as we get down to the nitty-gritty, they need to win these few games they have in hand. Anything could happen in that top five still, but as it stands, they currently are right around the middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference.
National Hockey League has made some news here as we get into the preseason. A lot of restricted free agents have been signed. Ivan Provorov won for the Philadelphia Flyers. He got a 6-year contract. Mitch Marner of the Maple Leafs, 6 years. Jared Spurgeon of the Minnesota Wild got 7 years. Charlie McAvoy of the Boston Bruins with 3. Travis Konecny of the Philadelphia Flyers with 6. Brock Besser of the Canucks with 3, Brandon Carlo of the Boston Bruins with 2. Lots of money going into all of those players.
Yeah, also the Wild got Kevin Fiala. There's a lot of 6-year deals you were mentioning, kind of odd. The Bruins stayed on the lower side with only 2 and 3. And we see just a lot of money being thrown around to a lot of guys. Spurgeon for 7 years and like $53 million or somewhere around there.
$53 million over those 7 years.
Man, that's a lot of money for Jared Spurgeon, but, you know, Minnesota, they like to sign people to too long deals for a lot of money, so I guess this falls right into their master plan.
That's ex-Penguin Bill Guerin making his move out there in Minnesota.
Guess, yeah, it is one of his first moves as new GM out there.
Mitch Marner will be making just under $11 million per year in his deal with the Maple Leafs. I think that's a little bit more. He's a very good player, but I think it's a little bit more than he's worth. Provorov's the other big one at 6.75.
He's actually the only one I think of those 6 years I like the most. He is better on the Flyers defense than most people. 6 years for a young guy like that, not terrible. And like when you see Jared Spurgeon getting as much as he does, you can afford to give Provorov over 6. So
I personally am a bigger fan of the bridge deals, like a Brock Besser getting 3 years at just over 17.5. Give him a chance to prove himself before you sign him to a long-term, lot of money type of contract. But that's what's going on in the NHL.
The fun thing about most of these guys is in about 3 or 6 years when their deals are done, we'll be doing the same thing all over again. So good news for these teams to get them locked up now, but there are still a few key names out there. We'll talk more about that in the coming weeks as we get closer to the season, but most of the restricted free agents are done. Moving into college football, week 3 saw a little bit more exciting results, but not as exciting as we're probably going to see in the upcoming weeks. Michigan State, Maryland, USC, they were all in the top 25. They fell out because they all lost their games. Entering in place of them is Cal, Arizona State, who did beat Michigan State, and TCU. Top 9 stayed the same. There were some movements, very little in the teens, just people moving up or down one or two spots or towards the lower end. We saw some more movement based upon the teams falling out. But in general, not too volatile of a week in college football.
Yeah, that movement includes Utah jumping Florida to get to 10, and UCF jumping to 15. Oregon goes to 16, and Texas A&M goes to 17. We will have 3 top 20 matchups coming up this week, and we will talk about those more later. But slowly we see some things shifting in college football, but this week will certainly really get us going.
Big news for Florida. While they still did win last week, are in the top 10, they did lose starting quarterback Felipe Franks for the season. They have a very tough SEC schedule, as we previewed a few weeks back. So without their starting quarterback, it's going to be difficult. But their backup did lead them back against a good Kentucky team. So take that for what you will. Penn State and Iowa also barely escaped by less than one score in each of those two games, but needless to say, they both won. So, yeah, a little bit happened, not too much. Jalen Hurts is still amazing. He's the best college football player right now, I think. He's the best quarterback. He could be argued as the best running back, too. He's just doing it all for this Oklahoma team. So exciting to see what he does moving forward as conference play starts to heat up.
Absolutely. That wraps up First and Short. Now we're going to get into the meat of the show, starting with the National Football League, where...
Boy, oh boy, is there a lot to talk about.
There is just everything going on in the National Football League right now. A couple of results from Week 2 here. We have 9 teams sitting at 2-0, 9 teams sitting at 0-2. Everybody else is obviously in the middle. Some have a tie. Detroit and Arizona, looking at you. We had some wild finishes in Week 2. Chicago at Denver ended up 16-14. All kinds of stuff happened when the Broncos scored to tie. Well, what we thought was going to be to tie the game. They tried to go for 2, penalty, get backed up, decide to kick the extra point, penalty on the defense. They get the ball actually closer than where they originally started. They convert for 2. Then we get Chicago gets some help from a questionable call from the officials.
Same dumb roughing the passer.
And it ends up being a game-winning 53-yard field goal from Eddie Pinheiro, I believe I'm saying that right, Pinheiro. And Chicago ends up taking that game. Jacksonville at Houston, it was a similar type of story. The Jaguars decided that they would score and try to go for 2 and win the game. They did not convert. They lose 13-12. Philadelphia and Atlanta looked like it was going to be Philadelphia's game until Julio Jones took a screen pass much further than any other person would take a screen pass, and it results in a 24-20 win for Atlanta. So some very odd finishes to games in Week 2. Very exciting finishes as well.
It's very interesting that you mentioned the first two games. It was 13-12 in both of those situations. One team misses the 2 points, 13-12 is the final. The other team makes the 2 points, yet somehow 16-14 still ends up being the total. Interesting storylines there. But yeah, Philadelphia, it was a good game. Them and the Falcons, they actually, both teams played really well. Philadelphia, though, we'll highlight a little bit more later, they were just getting injuries left and right. So for them to stay in the game as long as they did against the Falcons was impressive. But like you said, Julio Jones took a screen pass about 54 yards to the house for a touchdown. I believe that was a 4th down play, too, that he did that on.
I think so.
Which ultimately gave Atlanta the victory in the end. We saw Carson Wentz exit the game briefly. And was it Luke or Josh? Which one is it? One of the McCown brothers. Apologies to them. It's so hard to keep them in line with each other. Either way, whichever one most recently retired and came back, he came in for a few snaps for the Eagles, but Wentz came back, and either way, the Eagles didn't get the job done, so they're at 1-1, along with most of the other teams in the league, like you mentioned. Some teams that are 2-0 that look like they're the strongest pack leaders right now. New England Patriots, of course, they have given up 3 points in 8 quarters, 6 points in 12 quarters if you go back to the Super Bowl. They shut out a Dolphins team that looks like it could compete with Alabama for the national championship this year. The Patrick Mahomes-led Kansas City Chiefs, also not as dominating as an effort as they would have liked, but he put up an impressive second quarter, threw 4 touchdown passes, about 300 yards, all in the second quarter. It just made it look so effortless. And then another quarterback doing some stuff that people did not expect, Lamar Jackson. He is by far the best quarterback through these first 2 weeks. That will change, of course, but he has led the Ravens at 2-0 as well. So those three teams, I think, are the top of the pack right now as we sit.
Yeah, some other teams that fall into that 2-0 category, the Buffalo Bills probably won't.
Nobody circles the wagons like them, Matt.
They probably won't be in this conversation of undefeated teams for all that long, but they're there for now. The Dallas Cowboys have looked very good.
They look excellent.
I didn't give them a lot of credit coming into the season. I don't totally trust the Cowboys, and we'll see what Cowboys team we get here as the season goes on. But right now, they look very good. Green Bay, another
Their
team
defense.
In the NFC that looks very good, a revamped defense, and, of course, a healthy Aaron Rodgers. The Rams, a team you would expect to see there, obviously got some help from a Drew Brees injury, which we'll get into more here in a little bit. The 49ers, a team that I like a little bit more, I think, than most. But
I think people are going to start to come on to them like you have.
Yeah, they've taken care of business. And
twice
as
on
they,
the road.
Yeah, and as they should against the Bengals team, I think, 41-17 this past week.
Yeah,
so.
They blew up.
And then the Seattle Seahawks are 2-0, which I don't think is going to last. That might be the team on this 2-0 list that I'm least confident in, is the Seahawks.
Less confident than the Bills?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think so. I think preseason I had them roughly in the same spot, 7-9. Give or take.
I might have had
the Seahawks at a 6-10. But no, I look at those two teams pretty similarly. But I think the difference is I look at the Bills as a more up-and-coming team with Josh Allen at quarterback, and I look at the Seahawks as a team trending downward, having lost the majority of the defense that won them their Super Bowls. So I think that's where I have the difference between those two.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, the Seahawks have beaten Bengals 0-2, Steelers 0-2. Steelers, I think, are
And they didn't win either of those games in convincing fashion. No, they, 3 points combined, I believe. So
they came back against the. They came back against both. Actually, they were down to the Bengals and they were down to the Steelers at halftime. Came back against both. The Bills in the first week against the Jets, they were horrible in the first half and excellent in the second half. And in this week against the Giants, they're going through the whole state of New York now, just dominate them. But the Giants are very, very bad.
Right.
So they should have handled that one, but they're. Bill's defense has always been good. It's just their offense has always been even so terrible, usually ranking in the bottom 10, bottom 5 of the league. So Josh Allen can stay healthy. I mean, I can see the Bills as a team 8-8 maybe. And the Seahawks still, is Russell Wilson is the leader of that team. And the defense, like you said, it's not as strong. It's good enough to win some games, but they're not going to beat teams like the Rams, though.
0-2 teams. We have Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Miami, New York Jets, Jacksonville, Denver, New York Giants, Washington, and Carolina. Which of those teams do you think has the best chance of getting themselves back to relevance from a rough 0-2 start?
I want to say the Steelers, but that's biased, so I will exclude them from this discussion because of that. Honestly, I think the Redskins have probably looked the best out of the rest of the teams you listed there.
They've been competitive in both of their games.
But I don't think they're going to come back, though. They're a team that Case Keenum has been good enough, but Darius Geis, once again, is missing significant portion of the season due to another injury. He is a very good running back when he's healthy, but in the NFL, we have not seen Darius Geis healthy.
Half a game in a year plus now?
Yeah, honestly, he'll come back later in the season, but to what capacity, who's to say? The Giants and Jets, they are bad. That is a firm fact. The Dolphins are in their own league. There will also not be discussed in this because there's no chance for them. The Bengals, I think both of us thought were going to be terrible going into the season. And
yeah, I have no expectations for the Bengals whatsoever.
Yeah, they'll get some wins, but not too much. The Broncos, I think, are the most interesting on that list, though. I think they have the best upside, but they have shown maybe the least, I think, of all of these. Well, once again, excluding the Dolphins, because they held the Bears to a very competitive game.
A game that they probably should have won.
Yes. I mean, they did only score 14 points, which shouldn't win you games. But they did hold the Bears to, who looked very bad, 16. For the majority of the game, it was single digits. I believe it was like 6-6 or 6-9 or something at halftime. It was low scoring for sure. First week, they looked really bad against the Raiders. It was a new coach. It was still new quarterback, Joe Flacco. He's old, but he's new to the Broncos. They're still trying to get all the pieces working together, but their defense has been good enough. I think they can win some. It's still very tough to play at Mile High Stadium. I think their defense is good enough to get them some more wins there, especially whenever they have to play a disheveled-looking Chargers team. Even the Chiefs once won't be a guaranteed victory for Kansas City, and Oakland back at home should be a win for them. So they can get some wins here and there. I like them a lot.
Yeah, Denver and Pittsburgh, to me, are the two that I think have the best chance. I think they're the only two on this list that I had in my preseason standings being above 500. So I would certainly look for those two to bounce back. Carolina, I feel like, is a team that should be able to bounce back. But in the last year and a half, I don't know that we've seen much that suggests they will. I mean, I don't think that they're going to finish at a 3-13 type of record. I think they'll be average. But I outside of McCaffrey, I don't know who on that team I trust enough to say, oh, yeah, they'll bounce back from 0-2 and be in playoff contention.
You'd like to say Cam Newton.
You would like to, but can you?
At this point, no, you can't.
And he might not even play this week.
I know. It's very unfortunate. You can't say that. Well, last week, I think they probably would have rather him not play. He completed over half of his passes to the ground. He was, I believe, about 25 for 51 in the air, that's a lot for Cam Newton to be throwing. Christian McCaffrey got shut down. And what was most confusing of all this to me was it was against the Bucs, who I guess they're better than – I just never have a good interpretation of what the Bucs are. And I don't think they do either. Jameis Winston is bad. He is not showing enough at this point in his career, yet their defense is good enough, I guess, to get them some games.
After losing Gerald McCoy, it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be, but the Panthers look just horrible. I mean, I guess it was the Bucs defense looking good. You have to imagine at that point it was. I mean, to keep McCaffrey under, I think it was maybe 60 yards all-purpose, 70, somewhere around there, when he put up over 200 the week before, it's impressive for the Bucs at least.
I think it says something if a team like the Buccaneers can game plan to take away McCaffrey and then Cam Newton can't hurt them. To me, that's a problem if you're the Carolina Panthers.
Well, the Panthers don't have top receivers anymore. Kelvin Benjamin, while he's not by any means...
That's a good point.
Is he in the league still?
Yeah, somewhere. Maybe the Chargers?
Or is that Travis Benjamin you're thinking
of? Yeah, it's Travis Benjamin. I don't know about
Kelvin
yeah.
Benjamin was a number one receiver for Cam Newton and was above average, not good, sometimes good, not great, but definitely an above average receiver for a number of years. He fell off. He got sent out. Now they have DJ Moore and Curtis Samuel, and Devin Funchess isn't there anymore. They just don't have the receivers that Cam Newton needs. And his body has taken a big toll. I mean, he's gotten hit so much by trying to be such an athletic-type quarterback that he's just not as athletic anymore. That's why we're starting to see the injuries pile up more and more. So you can't put all your faith into him like you did 4 years ago, 5 years ago. It's a lot more difficult. And like you said, the Buccaneers game plan for them well. I think other teams down the road will be able to do the same.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with these 0-2 teams. A couple other surprises from week two. The Arizona Cardinals just don't want to be counted out of football games. They're 0-1-1. They haven't won yet, but they seem to find a way to...
They've been competitive both
Yeah,
weeks.
They make people think, oh, yeah, they're out of it, and then they fight back and make it a competitive game against a Ravens team that's looked impressive.
Kyler Murray's looked good.
Yeah, he's 54 of 94, 657 yards, 2 touchdowns, 1 pick right now in the season.
He's passing, I think, a little bit more than the Cardinals would like, especially when you have David Johnson. But
yeah,
he's not bad. I mean,
no, he's looked all right
if
for
anything,
a guy in his first two games.
He's given them a lot to look at moving forward, at least.
Yeah. Another surprise, the Detroit Lions knocked off the Chargers 13-10. Surprises me a little bit less, I think, than some people. But what really surprises me is that the Chargers punter is still kicking field goals for them. He's 1 for 3 in the game, I believe, in this past game. To me, get a kicker. Like, I know that kickers aren't necessarily the most plentiful of positions, but get a kicker that isn't your punter.
Well, they're plentiful. It's just, are good ones plentiful?
Well, yeah.
Not so much. But yeah, it's funny. You said the Lions are a surprise. I had the Chargers on my list as, like, a team that's serious concerns about.
Sure.
For similar reason. Their kicker, Michael Badgley, he's been injured. I believe it's like a groin injury or something. So he missed the first two games. He hasn't dressed either of those two games, which means the Chargers knew he was not going to play either of those two games, which means as the Los Angeles Chargers, you have the opportunity during the course of your entire week to go out and find a replacement kicker for these 2, 3, 4, I don't know how many games he's going to end up missing, but you find a replacement kicker so you're not forcing your punter into a situation that he is not good, not comfortable, and clearly not able to live up to the standards of. Last week, they lost 13-10. It was a game where if you have a kicker who can make field goals, it's a game you win. I'm not saying that the kicker necessarily would have made the field goals, but still, when you have, like, let's just say for argument's sake, they have like a Chris Boswell type guy. He's not the best, but he will kick more field goals than he won't. If you have him on your team, he will be able to provide you a comfort level at least, so you're not worried about, oh man, we have to rely on the punter and make these field goals. Especially in a tight game against the Lions, who I don't think they should have had this close of a battle with in the first place. I think their offense is good enough to put up more than 10 points. While the kicker was the reason they didn't win the game, I don't think it was the reason they lost the game, though. And it's very concerning, because especially the first week, they went to overtime against Indianapolis, ended up winning. But still, an Indianapolis team that was without Andrew Luck took the Chargers at home to overtime. Now they lose to Detroit. What's the next following week supposed to look like for the Chargers? They have the Texans this week. That's not an easy game by any means. The Texans have looked very good in their first two games. It's just very hard to put faith in the Chargers right now when they're not able to take care of the teams they should have. It reminds me of the Steelers of last year a lot.
Yeah, when you have your first two games each being decided by one possession, you would think you would want a kicker and not a punter kicking your very important field goals.
You think it injured during the game. They knew it. It's just...
Right.
You have the roster.
They're
spot.
Doing this consciously. They didn't get stuck in this position. They're going to continue to do it. Ideally, they pick up a kicker, but we'll see what they do. Another team that has some kicker issues is the Indianapolis Colts. Now, I feel confident that Adam Vinatieri will get over this funk that he's in, but so far in the season, he's 1 of 3 kicking field goals and 2 of 5 kicking extra points.
It's rough.
This is a, 4-time Super Bowl champion, Adam Vinatieri. A mid-40s Adam Vinatieri.
Late 40s, actually, at this point. I think he's 47
now. Okay, okay.
He's up there, but... It's weird because he was quoted on Sunday as saying to reporters, oh, you'll see me tomorrow, talking about Monday. And they're like, well, we don't, the press doesn't meet with you guys on Monday. He goes, oh, you'll see me. So I, along with many others, took that to believe he's retiring, he's done. And then their coach comes out and says, no, we got faith in Adam. He's our kicker. So I guess he's going to be the kicker for at least this week. I mean, there's a very good chance he'll be missing in the next coming weeks. But if the coach has confidence in him and Vinatieri has commented himself, then go for it, I guess. I mean, it's hard to tell a guy like that, no, you're cut. I think it's going to be his decision to retire in the end.
Yeah, but in the game where they win by 2 points, certainly you would like to have Adam Vinatieri making some more field goals and more extra points than what he has at this point. But those are some surprises I had from week two. Now the big news from week two is the injuries. The injuries are everywhere. And let me start with something that you already touched on, the Philadelphia Eagles. You mentioned Carson Wentz was out of the game, briefly came back in. DeSean Jackson and Alshon Jeffery, receivers 1 and 2 for this Philadelphia Eagles team, left that game, did not return to that game, and by the sounds of it, will be out somewhere around 2 weeks each. Alshon Jeffery's dealing with a calf injury. DeSean Jackson has an abdominal strain. So for the Philadelphia Eagles, interesting position to be in without your top two wideouts.
It's tough, and Nelson Agholor, while he is fine, he did get removed from the game. He might have came back, but he certainly missed some time in the game on Sunday.
Yeah, he did
as
return.
Well.
He did return.
Corey Clement, he's a returner more than a running back, but he's also injured for multiple weeks. He has a shoulder problem, so there's just a lot of injuries on this Eagles team. Jackson and Jeffery, though, that's huge. I mean, that's your 1 and 2 receivers. Nelson Agholor, he's a decent slot receiver, but he is by no means a number one. And beyond him, I don't even know who's on their team. Zach Ertz is at tight end. Dallas Goedert, their backup tight end, he does not make a big impact, but you would think he would be making a bigger impact with these guys injured. Well, he got injured himself, so his status is up in the air for Sunday as well. There's just a lot of injuries on this Eagles team. Carson Wentz, thankfully for him, will be playing this upcoming week, but he seems to be spearheading the injury effort on the Eagles too.
Yeah, and they have some weapons at running back with a guy like Miles Sanders, a guy like Jordan Howard, and then I believe Darren Sproles after that. So certainly, yeah, especially a guy like Sproles, I mean, can play a role in the passing game as well. So, you know, maybe those are some wrinkles that get thrown in there as well. But yeah, the Eagles have their fair share of injuries. Come to the other side of the state, and the Steelers have their fair share of injuries. Obviously,
goodness.
There's the big one, but before we get to that, safety Sean Davis has been placed on IR with a shoulder injury. They go out and trade for Minkah Fitzpatrick from the Miami Dolphins. Personally, I think that that's a better option anyway.
Yes.
But still, it's the fact that you're putting somebody on the IR, and obviously that's one less guy that you had to work with in the most previous game where any extra personnel could have made the difference. James Conner at running back is questionable with a knee injury. That one doesn't sound as serious, but it is your starting running back. Jalen Samuels is behind him, and I think we have some faith in Jalen Samuels, but I mean, things start to pile up, and I think after week one even there was Juju was questionable. I think TJ was questionable at one point. So Minor things here and there that you hope don't add up, but of course one major thing that certainly is a foregone conclusion, Ben Roethlisberger will not be suiting up at any point in the 2019 season.
No, he non-contact injury on his right elbow, his throwing elbow. He was cited as having inflammation during last week in practice or whatever. He looked okay in the first quarter, there was nothing obvious about him, and then all of a sudden he had one pass and he clutched his elbow and he threw another pass after that, and that was pretty much all she wrote for Big Ben in this season. Not Tommy John surgery, which is for your UCL, your ulnar collateral ligament, it's in your elbow. Think of it as the ACL of your elbow or whatever. Pitchers get it all the time. Either way, he won't be getting that, but the details of the surgery will be revealed, I guess. I don't know if the surgery's happened yet or
I think they were going to schedule it for this week, but I don't know.
By the time we do the show next week, we should probably have more details about the circumstances surrounding that. But he is not an option for the Steelers this year. It's gone. It is Mason Rudolph time. It's very funny. I saw something interesting. In Bill Cowher's 13th season, Tommy Maddox was the starting quarterback. In his second game, he had an elbow injury, which ended his season. In Mike Tomlin's 13th season, Big Ben has an elbow injury in the second game, which has ended his season. I don't think Mason Rudolph is the next Big Ben, but boy, would I love him to be. But either way, it's just a funny dynamic we have here.
It's kind of freaky, yeah.
I know Mason Rudolph has had much success at Heinz Field. When he played at Oklahoma State, he set Big 12 records left and right. And I believe they played Pitt once or twice at Heinz Field, and he put up like 50-some points. So he has no problem playing there. And then this week, he actually looked good. It's a strong word to use. He didn't light up the field. He did not lead the Steelers to success, obviously, but he also did not lead the Steelers to failure. I felt more comfortable with him there than I had at any other point I have ever seen. Let me give you a big list. Dennis Dixon, Charlie Batch, Byron Leftwich, Mike Vick, Landry Jones. Any of those times that those five names, among others, took quarterback while Ben was injured or dealing with whatever at the time, it was always like, all right, guess we're chalking this one up as an L, or, you know, we'll go 500 during this stretch of games that Ben misses. But with Rudolph, I feel confident enough. But still, for me, I think the biggest thing comes down to the coaching, the game planning they do. Roosevelt Nix, starting fullback, very good, very underused. Well, he won't be used because he's also been listed as out for this week.
That's another one.
As he was last week. But I think he's going to get more inclusion in this offense moving forward. We don't run the ball enough. Last year, Ben threw, I think, probably the most yards, most attempts, most completions in the league. Like you said, more than he ever has in any other season, because our offensive coordinator, former quarterbacks coach Randy Finkner, says, all right, Ben, you got 55 in you this week? Great. Let me see him out there. And instead of giving it to one of our running backs, which is now by committee, which it's not ideal, but it's okay. Connor is good when he's not injured, which is too much. Samuels is a capable backup, I think he's proven. Benny Snell had one very good run and then decided to ride the pine the rest of the game last week. I don't know what the theory is behind that. But either way, I think there's enough pieces surrounding him that instead of us having, or choosing to, I'm not even saying we had to rely on Ben. We have chosen to rely on Ben so much in this offense. I think we now have the ability to maybe have a more dynamic approach.
Two very quick points, and then we'll move on. I feel very strongly about both of these. Number one, Mason Rudolph can handle it. He looked good in the preseason. He looked good in...
He looked confident, too.
Yes, he looked good when he came in for Ben. I don't think Mason Rudolph will be a problem. He's not going to be Ben. I mean, Ben's a future Hall of Famer and a Super Bowl champion. Mason Rudolph needs some experience before he's in a Ben Roethlisberger-type conversation.
Boy, wouldn't it be great if he was.
Eventually, maybe he could be, but he will handle it just fine this year. Number two, the problem is Randy Feuchner. As long as he's calling the plays, this offense will not reach its potential. You talked about how much the Steelers have relied on Ben Roethlisberger, even though they don't need to. The fact that you have a Pro Bowl running back in James Conner when healthy, not being utilized. The fact that you've got a guy like Benny Snell who's shown some flashes, not being utilized. The fact that we have five plays in the offensive playbook.
Screen left, pitch left, quick slant, quick curl, punt.
Draw up the middle, gun it down the field. That's pretty much the extent of what the Steelers have going on. Until that changes, that's going to be the problem. People can point
on offense.
Yeah, people can point the finger at Ben's injury, Antonio Brown leaving, or Le'Veon Bell leaving all they want to. The problem is that Randy Feuchner is the one calling the plays. Moving on from the Steelers, there are other quarterback injuries. Drew Brees is out roughly 6 weeks for the New Orleans Saints.
At least 6 weeks.
Smashed his thumb into the gigantic hand of Aaron Donald. Ligament damage, I believe, is what's going to be keeping him out.
Tore ligament in his thumb.
I have some faith in Teddy Bridgewater. Again, though, he's no Drew Brees. Taysom Hill will be there as well. I would like to think they'll use Taysom Hill the same way they've been using him and not try to put him in a quarterback position that I think Bridgewater can play. But regardless, Brees will be out until probably after their bye week.
See, it's very funny you say that because Sean Payton this week said, well, we don't have a quarterback one and two. We have two quarterbacks, indicating to me that Bridgewater and Taysom Hill will be lining up in pretty much any offensive position this week that Sean Payton can think imaginable. Maybe he likes to put weird formations out there. Taysom Hill is a quarterback by nature, but under Sean Payton, he plays special teams.
Literally everything.
Receives. Yeah, he might as well kick the ball. He does it all, but he is technically a quarterback on their depth chart. Teddy Bridgewater, he's a former Pro Bowler, had very good season with Minnesota before he blew his knee out, unfortunately for him. Obviously never came back in the same capacity that we saw him as, but this is as good a chance as any to show that he is more than capable of running an offense. He is the highest paid backup quarterback in the league. He makes, I believe, around $7 million as the backup. So the Saints have a lot of insurance behind Drew Brees. It's just a matter of him showing up last week. Of course, they were playing the Rams. The Rams are a very good team.
Sure.
So it's a lot harder to see what kind of what he has to offer against
potential.
Potential he has to offer against a team like that. But you still have Alvin Kamara. You still have Michael Thomas.
There's weapons all over the place on that team.
Yeah, their offense is exhilarating. He will not produce as Drew Brees did, but I think he is capable enough to get them at least 500 in the time that he's gone. Maybe a game over, but I would say at least 500.
A couple other quarterback headlines out of New York. Sam Darnold did not play on Monday Night Football. He is still sick with mono.
Imagine that.
Trevor Siemian comes in, snaps his ankle. He's out for the season.
Imagine that.
So the Jets have quite the quarterback issue going on there. Although, was it Luke Falk? Is that the name?
Luke Falk is their starter.
I thought he looked better than Siemian in that game anyway. So maybe it's not as big a deal that he is the guy in. But either way, not good for the Jets at least. Darnold won't be out too long. It's not something like Ben's dealing with or even like Breeze is dealing with.
I think
with.
They said at week five they were eyeing a return for Darnold.
It's a little bit longer than you'd like to hear. Yeah. But again, Falk looked okay, better than Simeon, I thought, playing in that game.
Sure.
For the Giants, they've decided to bench Eli Manning in favor of Daniel Jones. I could not disagree with this move more. You have a two-time Super Bowl champion at your starting quarterback position. You've got Daniel Jones, who, regardless of whether or not people think he went where he should have in the draft, to me, it's a very simple concept. You draft the quarterback of the future. He sits behind your established quarterback, and then when the time is right, he takes over. He's had some experience. He knows the system, and he has success. Instead, we're seeing Daniel Jones get thrust into a position that he has no business being in right now. The Giants have no expectations for the season, regardless of who's at quarterback, and with the lack of talent across that team, Eli Manning is far from being the problem. I think this is the worst move the Giants could have made. This is just bad all over the place.
It's deja vu. We talked about this exact same thing last season, except it was the Arizona Cardinals.
Yep.
Sam Bradford looked terrible in his first 2 weeks because Sam Bradford is not a good quarterback. They put Josh Rosen, who I still don't think is a good quarterback, into a dumpster fire that was the Cardinals, which was a team that was going nowhere, had no weapons, no hope or prayer of doing well, said, all right, well, this guy was not good, so you're going to be even worse, but we're going to have faith in you because you were our first-round draft pick. Well, look how that turned out for Josh Rosen. He's now backing up Ryan Fitzpatrick. For this week, at least. I have a feeling that the Dolphins are going to pull a similar tactic. But yes, Eli Manning he's obviously past his prime. He's been past his prime. He's not the great quarterback that he used to be. But he is still a guy who I think should be the Giants starter. They have Saquon Barkley. That's it. That's a period statement because their team is so thin everywhere else. Their receivers, Sterling Shepard is their number one because they traded Odell Beckham. Well, he has a concussion problem. So he didn't play last week. I'm not sure if he's playing this week. Their offensive line is not good. That's why Eli has gotten worse so fast because he gets sacked six times a game. Their defense, they gave away all their good people. Eli Apple.
After struggling last year in the first place.
Damon Harrison also left. Yes, they all struggled last year and got shipped off. Their George Jenkins, the one good player on their defense, said, well, how am I supposed to cover a guy for 10 seconds if you guys can't rush the passer? To which another Giants pass rusher said, yeah, he has a point. I mean, this team is
a mess. It has a long list of problems. Eli Manning was never one of them, yet for some reason they're making that change. It's wrong. It's unfair.
It's very unfair.
At the end of the day, it's unfair to a guy who's been given a lot to that franchise since 2004 when he was drafted. Kind of a crappy way to repay him here towards the end of his career. I think he has more to give, whether or not that's with the Giants. We will see, but I think Daniel Jones will struggle through no fault of his own.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, the Giants are a team that has a 3-win ceiling. They have shown nothing. Eli Manning, I'm sure, will come back in some capacity this season. People have talked about him getting traded places. I don't think a guy like this is going to get traded in his career. I think he has a no-trade, no-movement clause or whatever, so it's up to him to do what he wants. One more note on Luke Falk, though. Before the season began, there were no Washington State quarterbacks leading teams. However, starting week three, there will be two Washington State quarterbacks. Luke Falk will be starting for the Jets. Gardner Minshew will be starting for the Jaguars. So at the beginning of the season, we had Andrew Luck, Nick Foles, Sam Darnold, Cam Newton, Ben Roethlisberger, Drew Brees, and Eli Manning. Seven quarterbacks I've just rattled off to you that have all started games for the team this season. We are already at week three. None of those seven. Cam Newton may start, but the rest of the six guys I mentioned will absolutely not be starting this week. It's just been one thing after another.
Yeah, Washington State, go Cougars.
That's all we got for the NFL. We're going to take a quick break right now, but coming up we have a lot of MLB season wrap-up to be talked about, and of course, quick picks and bold predictions, so please stay tuned.
Welcome back to the show, Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris on RMU Radio. Let's move into Major League Baseball. Just before we're going to do some awards here. But before we get to that, let's talk about where we're at here as we get to roughly 10 games from the end of the season. National League, we've got the Atlanta Braves, St. Louis Cardinals, and the LA Dodgers leading their divisions. In the American League, it's the Yankees, Twins, and Astros. That has pretty much stayed the same for
as long
as... The
Braves clinched, though.
Okay, the Braves did clinch.
A playoff spot, not the
division. Right, not the division.
That is new as of last week, though.
The Nationals, I guess, are the only team at this point that has a chance at them, but they're 9.5 back. It's not going to happen. It will be the Braves division. It's just a matter of time. The Nationals do, however, lead the wild card race. They are followed by the Brewers and the Cubs, who are tied for the second spot. And then we've got the Mets and the Phillies, each within 4 games after those two. On the AL side, I believe we have the Oakland Athletics leading. They have the top wild card spot by 2.5 games. Then we've got the Tampa Bay Rays at the second wild card, and slightly behind them are the Cleveland Indians. I think it's certainly safe to say at this point the Red Sox in the AL and the Diamondbacks in the NL have no chance.
Yeah, the Diamondbacks, while they are 5 games back, they are 3-7 in their last 10. There's not enough games left in the season for them to be this consistently far back.
And just so many teams still in between them. Like, it's not just one team. They have to jump a whole bunch.
The Mets, the Brewers, the Cubs, there's 4 teams that separate them from the top
spot. Making
up
5 games on 4 teams in a week and a half, 2 weeks is not easy.
It's possible, but the direction they've headed in this most recent time kind of says they're out. The Red Sox, we've talked about being out. It's only a matter of time before they're mathematically eliminated. They're 9 back, 79 and 71. They're done. There's no chance for them. They are out. The Central has pretty much been the same as it's been. It's been about 3 game difference for the Cubs and Cardinals for the last 2-3 shows we've done. And now here we are still 2.5 up. Time is ticking. The game differential is not ticking. Of course, a big series between the Cubs and the Cardinals is coming up this weekend, though. But up to that point, though, nothing else has changed. Nationals have fallen a little bit. They had a bigger lead as the top spot. Now it's only 1 game. And in the same time they've fallen, the Brewers have risen. So the NL was a little bit stretched out. We're kind of chopping off the excess, and we're kind of condensing them for which is going to be a more exciting end to the season than I thought we were going
to
see.
Boy, I got to give some credit to the Brewers because they are 9-1 in their last 10, and we sat here last week and said no chance now that Yelich is gone. I still don't think that the Brewers are going to end up there, but they certainly, assuming they don't, are going to go down with a fight. They're going to fight the whole way as they sit with 82 wins right now. So certainly they are as much in it as they have been all season.
I think it'll be interesting to see what happens now than they were a month ago. It's a lot less time than before, but there's still some time nonetheless. While the season is not over yet, we found it would be the best to fit into this week's show. We're going to give our award predictions for all of Major League Baseball. There's about a week and a half left. I don't think anything is going to happen that will change or sway our opinions really on who we have in what position. So we're going to give our award rundown this week. We're going to start with Manager of the Year. I'm going to start in the National League. And I'm going to give it to Dave Martinez of the Washington Nationals. Currently, the Nationals are 83-68. This is his second season with the team. The first year without Bryce Harper, really, this whole decade since the Nationals have been relevant again. I did not think the Nationals were going to be above 500, let alone in a wild card spot. Yet Dave Martinez has got his team in a position to get them to the postseason. There's still some time left. They may not make it, but they have a winning record for sure. They've had good pitching. They have a +113 run differential, which is third best in the National League. They have what will be a winning record. Just a lot of good things have been happening to this Nationals team that I did not foresee. So for that reason, I give it to Dave Martinez.
I'm going to go to the LA Dodgers and go with Dave Roberts. I think in the National League, it's pretty up for debate. But with Dave Roberts, you're looking at a guy who's leading the Dodgers to a very dominant season in the National League. They sit at 98 wins right now, which is only a game back of the Yankees and Astros for the best record in all of Major League Baseball. They sit at 21 games better than anybody else in their division and 5 games better than anybody else in the National League.
It's crazy.
Obviously, they have a lot of talent on that roster, and it's not all Dave Roberts, but he is leading this team to the best season, kind of by a decent margin when you consider how close everything else is in the National League. So I like Dave Roberts.
Yeah, he's not a bad pick. I didn't think Dodgers would have as strong a season, but he said, no, we're going to be just as good this year as we were the last two. So not a bad pick. The AL, I think it's a pretty easy decision for everybody. I'm going to go to the Minnesota Twins. It is a guy who I did not even know was their manager until I looked it up today. Rocco Baldelli. I remember when he played for the Rays about 10 years ago as an outfielder. Boy, times have changed. He was average at best as an outfielder, but as far as his managing career goes, he is excellent. The Twins currently are 93-58, top spot in the AL Central, probably will end up having the top spot winning the division as we get to the end of the season. The Twins were a team that I don't think anybody had any aspirations of going into the season. Yet, as it stands right now, they have five people on their team who have 30 or more home runs, the first team to ever do that, I believe. There was a few teams had four. The Phillies 10 years ago had four players, but no team has ever had five players hit more than 30 home runs. The Twins do. They set a new Major League Baseball record for most home runs in a season with 1 month left to play. They've just had a lot of good things go their way for whatever reason. The biggest surprise of the year, Rocco Baldelli, first year as a manager, first year with the Twins. He has to be the pick, I think.
I have him as well. 93 wins, like you said. He's leading a division that we didn't even think that this Minnesota Twins team was going to contend for.
We wrote it
for.
Off as the Indians division.
We sure did. The home run record that you mentioned is just phenomenal by this team. Last time they won the division was 2010 when they had 94 wins. So he's doing something right now that Minnesota baseball has not seen in a long time. And it's very effective. The Twins look like a very dangerous team going into the postseason with the firepower that you talked about. Rocco Baldelli is my guy as well in the American League.
Moving to reliever of the year, used to be known as the Rolays reliever of the year because, hey, let's give sponsors the things. I'm not sure if they really do this title as much anymore, but I like the award because it's kind of random and fun. Going to the NL, I'm going to go to a team that has not really ever been in contention at all this season, but has managed to produce the best reliever. That is the San Diego Padres, and that is Kirby Yates, who currently sits atop the whole Major League Baseball leader list of saves. He has 40 saves and 43 opportunities. Only 58 innings pitched, so pretty much the only time you see him on the mound is whenever they need a save out of him. 1.23 ERA is great. 15.2 strikeouts per 9 innings pitched is just astounding. It's a remarkable number. 0.886 whip is also great. The only stat that's kind of says a lot about more about the Padres than him. He has an 0-5 record, which means if he ever blows a save, the Padres don't have any fight in them, which is unfortunate for him. 0-5 is not the best record, but reliever records don't really mean that much anyway. But he has just been lights out the whole season. Could have been traded at the deadline, probably. Instead, he stuck it out with the Padres, and he's going to end up with somewhere near 45 saves on the season.
Yeah, I have Kirby Yates as well. You talked about these fantastic numbers. The 1.23 ERA is just absolutely phenomenal. 99 punch-outs on the year, and opponents are hitting 187 off of him. So he's really been dominant throughout the entirety of the year. And you talked about not only does he have the most saves, but he's only blown three. He's been a very successful reliever in general, but also very successful at the closer position. So we're on the same page in the National League.
We'll see if we switch up in the AL. I'm going to go to the Oakland Athletics and choose Liam Hendriks. He has 23 saves and 29 opportunities. Not the highest save numbers, but he really hasn't been their dedicated closer for the entirety of the season. Took over in the summer and has just been lights out since he has. 81 innings pitched is a high number for a reliever, especially when we look at Kirby Yates has 40 saves in 58 innings. Hendriks has about 23 more innings pitched than him. Has a 1.66 ERA, 13.1 strikeouts per 9 innings, 0.971 whip. If you can have your whip, which is walks plus hits per innings pitched, under one, it is a very good number. Hendriks has, he is a guy that can even do two innings, three innings at a time if they need him. Not quite as dominant as Josh Hader, but good enough for the A's to get the job done, and I think good enough to be the AL reliever of the year.
I have him also as
you got him.
I do, yeah.
Nice.
I thought his numbers really jumped off the page to me. 118 strikeouts is a number you didn't mention, but that certainly caught my attention. Obviously, he's got some more innings pitched there than Kirby Yates, but 118 strikeouts is very good for any reliever. Opponents are hitting 200 off of him, so a little bit higher. I thought the National League had some better relievers to choose from than the American League did, but Liam Hendriks certainly stood out to me as the guy in the American League.
Absolutely. Moving into Rookie of the Year, we're going to go back to the National League. I'm going to choose mine from the Braves. No, it's not Ronald Acuna Jr. this time. It is pitcher Mike Soroka, who has just been extremely quiet all season. The only reason I have a strong knowledge of him is because he has provided my fantasy team great success. But he's 12-4 with a 2.57 ERA. That's second best ERA in the National League. He has 164 innings pitched, 0.7 home runs per 9 innings. That's the best mark in National
League. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, so imagine this. He pitches, let's say, 6 innings on average. He gives up not even one home run during that 6, about one every 2 games he pitches. Phenomenal. 7.1 strikeouts per 9 is not a lot, but he is not a strikeout pitcher. 1.093 whip is great. Opponents are hitting 232 off of him. This is his first full season. He pitched, I believe, 3 games last year in September. Nothing too remarkable for the Braves. But he has been the best pitcher on the Braves, and he's aiming in contention, I think, for Cy Young. He will not win the Cy Young, but he will certainly be top five in voting just because 2.57 is just so ridiculously low. He should be better than 12-4. He had a stretch of like 5 straight games where the Braves could not get any runs for him for whatever reason, but he certainly has had a great year. He is my National League rookie pick.
I'm going to the New York Mets and Pete Alonso.
Figured you would.
Yeah, I mean, some numbers that don't necessarily jump off the page is his 264 average, 946 OPS, and 93 runs scored is a decent number. But what really hits home is the 111 RBIs that he's racked up and the 48 home runs that lead all of Major League Baseball as a rookie. To me, that's those two numbers, especially the home run number, is all you need to know to make it Pete Alonso.
Yeah, I just didn't want to go with him because he was the easy pick. But
sure.
He'll probably end up winning. Brian Reynolds is another guy that I think we could have chosen, too.
Boy, if Pete Alonso wasn't hitting 48 home runs, yeah. I think you can make a real case for Brian Reynolds.
But unfortunately, when a guy will put up, he'll probably get 50 before the season's over. It's hard not to give it to him. I chose not to, but other people probably will not. Moving to the AL, a guy that I did not even know existed before he came onto the team this year, that is Yordan Alvarez, outfielder DH for the Houston Astros, has 26 home runs and 76 RBIs. Oh, that's only in 78 games played, too. So if he would play a full season, he would get about 160 RBIs, which is just an insane number. He's hitting .316, on base .418, which is stupidly high. And he has a 1.092 OPS, 23 doubles, too, just because why not? It's great numbers. But the best stat I found about this guy is his birthday is June 27th, which is the same as mine, just 1 year removed from me. So that just made me have to pick him for that. But for the, he's just been so good for the Astros. He will be dangerous for anybody in the postseason. Had a home run up on the third deck of the Astros Stadium the other day. He's just insane, my rookie pick.
Same birthday, but he's making things happen on the field, and you're talking about him on the radio. I'd say you're slacking a little bit.
A little bit.
I also have him, though. The only number I have that you didn't mention is he has 54 runs scored. But, yeah, everything that he's done in his short time is phenomenal. Yeah, I don't love the number of games that he's played, but no one in the American League that's a rookie has made the impact that he has. So he is my pick as well.
Moving into Cy Young, now we're getting to the meat of the awards. We're going to go to the National League. It's with a team you said had the manager of the year, the Los Angeles Dodgers. I have Hyun-Jin Ryu, 12-5 record on the year, 2.35 ERA, 168 innings pitched. Similar stat line to Soroka, 7.9 strikeouts per nine, not fantastic. 1.3 walks per nine, though, is the best mark in the league. A 1.026 whip is also phenomenal and 235 average. He was dominant early in the season, kind of cooled off a little bit, but has still been strong enough that I think he is deserving of the Cy Young.
I'm going to go back to the New York Mets and go with Jacob DeGrom.
DeGrom for the second straight season.
Yes, he's sitting at 9-8, which I don't really care about the record. I think that's a team stat and not a player stat. His ERA, however, is 2.61, 190 innings pitched, 239 strikeouts, whip is 1.01, opponents are hitting .212 off of him, and all of those numbers except for the win column is a top five stat in the National League. So I like Jacob DeGrom a lot.
How is he doing so well and having a 9-8 record? Last year,
that's a fantastic question.
He had 1.7 ERA and went 10-7 last year. He's 9-8 this year with 2 points.
The Mets don't like to help him, but that's why it's a team stat and shouldn't be given to the pitchers.
He's a very good pick. I think the National League is up in the air.
I agree.
The American League, it is. It won't be unanimous, but it very well could be. It's going to be Justin Verlander. The dude is just acting like he is not a day over 25. He is insane this season. 19-6, leads the Major League Baseball in, or in American League in wins with 19. 2.5 ERA, leads the American League. Has 212 innings pitched, which is ridiculous. 12 strikeouts per nine is insane. 1.7 walks per nine leads American League. 0.788 whip. I've never seen a whip number below 8, but he's managed to do it. Oh, and he threw his third no-hitter of the season this year. He only trails Garrett Cole in strikeouts, but if he would ever overtake Cole this season in strikeouts, he will be the Triple Crown winner once again. It's just been a season full of life for him, so Justin Verlander, hats off. It's easy pick.
Yep, we're on the same page here. 283 strikeouts. Opponents are hitting 169 off of him. When you look at wins, ERA, strikeouts, average against, whip, all of them are top two in all of Major League Baseball, not just the American League. He has been phenomenal, and as good as Garrett Cole has been, it should be Justin Verlander's award to lose.
Garrett Cole deserves the Cy Young.
He will just not get it
because Justin Verlander has been...
Because his own teammate is just a little bit better than
he is. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's amazing he even has 6 losses, too. How did the Astros not put up enough runs in 6 games that Verlander's pitched? I don't know. Either way, he'll get 20 wins, and he'll be smiling in the postseason. Moving into the MVP, I'm going to go to the National League and back to a team I've talked about before, the Dodgers. Cody Bellinger has been the best player for the National League this entire season. Currently has 44 home runs, 109 RBIs, hitting .304, .408 on base, 1.033 OPS, 31 doubles, and a stat I like a lot, 10 outfield assists. He does it on both sides, whether it's fielding, whether it's hitting. He has just been the life of the Dodgers this season. Started off super hot, cooled off a little bit, but has stayed strong enough to get 44 and over 100 RBIs. Great guy. Should be deserving of the MVP.
I'm going to take it in a different direction because why not? Anthony Rendon of the Washington Nationals is where I'm going to go. 34 home runs. That number is a little bit lower than some other guys who might be in this race, but 119 RBIs leads the National League. 332 batting average leads the National League, 113 runs scored, 1.040 OPS, and this guy has turned it on in the last month or so when the Nationals need him the most, and to me, that's what makes an MVP, is a guy who really steps up when the team needs him to make that push to get them headed towards the playoffs, and obviously, like you said, they were starting to build a little bit of a lead while he was doing that. To me, that's what makes an MVP. Certainly, Bellinger was very deserving and could very well win it. Sure, but I'm going to go with Anthony Rendon.
Yeah, Rendon's interesting. When you remove Bryce Harper from the team, Rendon stepped up to the plate. And it's very funny, we talked so much about Harper and Machado, I'll bring them up again. Neither of them are in our discussions, nor will they be in anybody's discussions this season, because neither of them had MVP-type seasons, yet they signed MVP-type contracts. It's ridiculous. One guy who did sign an MVP-type contract, who will, like I said, probably should be unanimous MVP, Mike Trout in the AL. This guy just doesn't seem to ever take a day off. He's hitting 45 home runs, 104 RBIs, .291, which isn't so high. But when you look at his .438 on base percentage and 1.083 OPS, which lead the American League, his 45 home runs leads the American League. He has the most walks, most intentional walks in all of baseball. He's had those kind of numbers for like the last 5 years. It's just, how do you argue against him? I don't even know who else could possibly even take away votes from him, let alone win the MVP. It's just, he's insane.
Alex Bregman was the only other one that I saw that could maybe looking at the numbers, could be in the conversation.
Votes,
but I think it's Mike Trout, too. The Angels are so bad, and he is the only thing that makes them
good.
Relevant. He's just a fantastic player. 11 stolen bases, 110 runs scored to go along with the numbers that you mentioned. Yeah, I agree. In the American League, it's Mike Trout.
So those are our picks for the Major League Baseball awards. It'll be some time before we get what those awards actually are, but for now, that's who we decide. As we wrap up the show, though, we do need to move into quick picks, so we are going to fly right into the NFL. Ravens and Chiefs, a big matchup this week, two 2-0 teams. I'm going to go with the Ravens in this one. The Chiefs' defense is not strong enough, I think, to deal with the way Lamar Jackson has been slinging the ball so far. I think he will be able to lead them in a very close, high, tight-scoring game, but I have the Ravens in this one.
I'm going to go with the Chiefs. They're at home. Arrowhead is a very difficult place to play. I need to see a little bit more from Lamar Jackson. He's tearing defenses up, but they're not good defenses that he's tearing up. The Chiefs aren't either, but if this game turns into a shootout, I'm not convinced he'll keep up with Mahomes. I'll go with the Chiefs. Texans at Chargers. Boy, I feel like this one could go either way. They've both been pretty average to this point, some close games. I'm going to go with the Chargers. It's really hard to get a grasp on either of these teams right now just with the way they're playing, but at home I'll take L.A.
I'm going to take the Texans because L.A. looked so bad last week. We talked about their kicking situation. Deshaun Watson is playing very well. He is good. Carlos Hyde is top five in the rushing. Look for him to hit the end zone this week against those Chargers for the Texans. Moving on to the West Coast still, we have the Saints and the Seahawks in an NFC matchup, which was a lot more exciting going into this week before Drew Brees got injured, but I'm still going to take the Saints in this one. The Seahawks have been just so shaky in their first two victories. I have trouble seeing them win a third straight game. It does not mean the same to play at the Seahawks stadium as it did 5 years ago. The Saints, I think, are good enough to be able to knock off the Seahawks.
I have the Saints as well. I told you that line about playing in Seattle isn't the same. You took it right out of my mouth and put it on the radio.
Sorry
before.
About that.
Oh, good. No, that's all right. We're on the same page, though. New Orleans still has all kinds of weapons, even with Drew Brees sidelined. They have a former Pro Bowler at the helm. I think the Saints will be okay. Moving into college football, some great matchups.
Good, great ones.
Number 11, Michigan at number 13, Wisconsin. And I'm going to go with the Badgers of Wisconsin. They have not allowed a point yet this season.
My goodness.
They have scored somewhere between 49 and 61 points in each of their games. Michigan had to go to double overtime against Army. I think it's Wisconsin's game.
For the same reason they went to double overtime against Army, I'm going to pick Michigan. I think that was a defining game for them. I think Harbaugh probably took them all in the locker and said, all right, I got 25 scholarships in my hand ready to break them all in half. We got to win this game against Wisconsin or else you're all off the team. it's a must win for Michigan. They were a team I thought that could compete with Ohio State for the Big Ten. Wisconsin was not one. They will win this game. I am very confident in it, so I'm going to go with Harbaugh and Wolverines. SEC matchup, number 8, Auburn travels to College Station to play number 17, Texas A&M. I'm going to go with the Aggies in this one. They are just, it's so difficult to play there. The real 12th man, not Seattle, is at College Station in Texas A&M. They are so good. Auburn did beat Oregon earlier in the season, but it was a close margin. I just think Texas A&M has the home advantage here.
I'm going with A&M as well. You're right. College Station's a tough place to play. They've outscored every opponent that they've played this year that isn't named Clemson, 103-10. Auburn has not been that dominant by any stretch of the imagination, so I'm going to go with Texas A&M. Number 7, Notre Dame taking on number 3, Georgia.
Top 10 matchup.
I'm going to go with the Bulldogs at home. They've been relatively dominant to this point. The Notre Dame defense, I think, is suspect. It's given up 17 and 14 points to some teams that maybe shouldn't have scored that many. This Georgia offense is tough to contain. I'm going to go with the Bulldogs.
Georgia is for real. Notre Dame is not. I don't like Notre Dame's inclusion consistently in the top 10, whether it's this year or last year. Georgia was a team I think is going to make the college football playoff without losing during the regular season. So, of course, they're going to knock off Notre Dame by at least 15 at home here, I believe, will be Georgia for sure. Moving into baseball, Cardinals and Cubs, we highlighted, was a key series, and it's, of course, one we're going to have to pick on this show. It's a 4-game set, so it could be split, but I think the Cubs are going to take this one in 3 games. I just think right now they're playing better baseball than the Cardinals. It's very meaningful baseball down the stretch. I think it's going to be really exciting, and I think the Cubs just have a slight advantage here at home.
So far this season, every time I've picked a baseball team to win a series, they've lost. So how do I get in the win column? Don't pick a baseball team.
Pick a tie.
I'm going with the split. It's going to be 2 games apiece. Neither one of these teams are playing outstanding baseball at the moment, so I'm going to say a 2-2 split in this series.
Very nice, but you still have the opportunity to get it wrong if they do not split.
I'm well aware.
All right, that's quick picks. Moving into bowl predictions. My first is going to come in the NHL. We haven't talked about it enough yet on the show this year. It will come in the coming weeks. Here's my little teaser for those weeks. Mikko Rantanen and Patrick Laine, they are two restricted free agents who have yet to sign with teams. According to their agents, neither of them are nowhere near close signing. So I don't think the two of them will combine to play 82 games this season. Could injuries play a factor in that? Sure. Could them being jerks and not wanting to sign, similar to William Nylander last year, have a big impact? Of course. Right now, it doesn't look like they're going to be with their teams to start the season. 82 combined is a full season for one team, but for both of them, I don't think they're going to reach that total.
Very interesting. All of mine are in the National Football League, so let's start with the Steelers. I voice my displeasure with Randy Feuchner. I don't think he's going to make it to the end of the season.
I hope he doesn't.
I think he's going to get fired. His poor play calling is just too much for me every time I watch this team. Too many passes. The offense currently ranks, through 2 games, 28th in yards per game, 29th in points per game, and 28th in scrimmage plays. He's horrible. He's holding the Steelers offense back. I think he gets fired before the end of the season.
Well, I'd love to see that happen. I'm going to go to the NFL this week. I said there's been 7 quarterbacks who start the season who no longer are starting this week. Well, I think following this week, there will be 2 new quarterbacks starting next week. So that will bring the total up to probably around 40 for the whole year. But I think from the 32 teams we have playing this week, there will be 2 new starters come the following week in the season.
I'll go with quarterbacks as well. I think Colin Kaepernick's going to make his return to the NFL.
Oh, boy.
Not necessarily as a starter. I just think with the number of quarterbacks that have gone down, the lack of starting quarterbacks that are available, I think somebody's going to get desperate enough, finally decide that they're going to take a chance on Colin Kaepernick, and he's going to be on an NFL roster.
It just means we're going to hear more and more about him that we don't need to if that happens. My last one will stick in the NFL. Week 8 is about the midpoint of the season. I think there will be at least one head coach fired by that point of the season. I don't know what team it could be on. Maybe it'll be Vikings came to my mind just because they seem to disappoint themselves a lot. It might not happen. It could be a terrible team like the Giants or the Jets even. But I still don't think an NFL coach will. There will be at least one fired before week 8. Maybe 2. Who's to say?
Final one for me, and I hate to say this, but I think the Miami Dolphins will go 0-16.
Ooh.
I don't like saying it, but they've traded a lot of guys. I'm not convinced that they're done trading players yet. Here's the thing. People will call it tanking. I think it's strategically tanking. I don't think they're doing it just to try to get a certain guy. I think they're trying to rack up as many picks as they can. I think they're making a push for next year. I think they'll do something next year, as I've said before on the show, but this year is going to be a struggle for them and for their fans. I think it's going to be an 0-16 campaign.
Somewhere in there, there's a joke about tanking and SeaWorld and Dolphins. I can't figure it out. Hopefully the listeners at home can.
That is all the time that we have This was Sports Takeover on Army Radio. Thanks for tuning in. As always, we'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, good night, everyone.